Sandy, welcome back to the show, my man. How you doing?
Hey, boys. How are you? A diamond in the rough, and definitely not 245 anymore. I'm bigger than ever.
Oh, well, hey, there.
Retirement's been good to me, just not so much to my waistline.
Okay. Okay. Nice.
It's all good. I'm only kidding. Tom knows that.
I was just going to say, man, you were always a guy who was in good shape, so I didn't think you'd, if anything, you probably lost weight a bit.
I'm mostly fun with you guys. I have. I'm like probably more in shape than I was even when I was playing. Honestly, I do more stuff that's kind to my body now than when I played, so I'm probably feeling better than I've ever felt, quite honestly.
Honestly, that's great. Now, Andy, for you, you're big, hulking defenseman. I like, in story time, I'd kind of like to talk about how you got to where you were. So, were you always a defenseman growing up? Did you play hockey right from a young age of six? You get into it late. Tell us a little bit about your minor hockey journey.
Yeah, for sure. And the stories are always so interesting. Every guy has a bit of a different one. And for me, I started out early. I took to it quickly. My dad loves the game, as much as anyone else. And, so I got into that, and then we shared in that to a very high degree. I started out as a defenseman, and I think maybe because I was bigger earlier, I was scoring a lot of points back there. And I guess the inclination was like, why don't we make him a forward? So at, I think, 11 years old, I turned into a forward, and I stayed there all the way through getting a scholarship to Tech as a forward out of St. Mike's in Toronto. I played there for 1 year, and at the time, that was probably the preeminent place in the country to go to try to get a scholarship, and thank goodness things aligned and got a chance to go to Tech. And then two years into that, it was the NHL lockout of 94, and Pierre Paget, there was a couple of NHL players practicing with our team, Randy McKay and Jim Storm. And Pierre Paget came in to spend a couple of weeks with our team. Coach was Bob Mancini at the time. I think he's the director of USA Hockey now. Pierre did an analysis of the team. At the end of the 2 weeks, he left notes on everybody. And Bob called me in his office and said, hey, do you want to hear what Pierre had to say? I'm like, oh, of course. He said, well, he wrote long things for a bunch of guys, but for you, all he said was try Sutton at defense. He said, what do you think? So I was like, well, my career's been fairly lackluster to this point, those sliding doors moments, those forks in the road where you're just like, oh, the hell with it, let's go for it, right? So I said, yeah, let's do it. So the rest of that year, was a bit of a struggle and adjustment. The junior year, I had a couple of injuries that I was working through and really wasn't that much to brag about. And then I don't know what happened, stars aligned or whatever, but the senior season was incredible. I mean, ended up winning the Defensive Player of the Year and was named All-American, and obviously never having been drafted, I had 14 teams try to sign me the day after my final game, and I went from having $7 in my bank account and eating microwave rice and beans to having every opportunity to live the dream of having a chance to play in the NHL. And the rest is kind of just, an insane story of ups and downs over a, 15-year span. I think I missed more games due to injury than any other player during that time span. So, I mean, I played then, 650-something games or something like that. But, I mean, if you look at it over the duration of time, I should have had, 1,200 or 1,300 games. So I missed half the games. And I remember when I went into New York and signed with the Islanders off of a great season in Atlanta and split that into Ottawa. I went in and talked to Garth Snow at the time, and I said, you got a great deal on me. He said, well, not really. You're one of the highest paid players in the league. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you only play 40 games a year, so figure it out. But it was a really great journey. I feel so thankful for all of it, and happy to be done now and spending time back at hockey again.
So, Andy, let's go at Michigan Tech. Yeah, you mentioned everything aligned, because you went two goals, and then boom, as a senior, 16 goals, 40 points. Like, you went 3-3, and you just exploded that last year up to 40 points, obviously feeling confident. Then you mentioned you had 14 NHL teams pursuing you. Why did you choose San Jose?
Well, at the time, they had a real veteran core. The two teams that rose to the forefront were San Jose and St. Louis. And at the time in St. Louis, they had McInnes and Pronger and a bunch of guys. And in San Jose, There were some guys that were veteran guys. You know, Brian Marchman was there, and Bob Rouse was there, Jeff Norton, Gary Suter. I mean, these are big time name guys. But at the time, I think I just thought, I think I've got a better chance to play here, to actually come in and offer something unique. I knew I would always have been under Pronger and McInnes's shadow, you know, and that would have been true for sure if I had gone there. So despite St. Louis offering me more money, I signed with San Jose, and that was the first difficult business decision that I had to make. And, you know, ended up having to make so many more throughout the course of my career. You know, all these little moments where you have these forks in the road are the reasons why I think you either stay or go. You know, even as much as, you know, asking for a trade from, you know, San Jose, getting exposed in the expansion draft, going to Minnesota, Jacques Lemaire, you know, tries to turn me back into a forward, right? And I just had a feeling that for longevity in the league, I had to be a defenseman. So I went in and respectfully asked for a trade. And Doug Risebrough, the GM at the time, was kind enough to trade me to Atlanta, I think within like 7 days. And then from there, you know, getting into Atlanta and, you know, having Bob Hartley there, the first thing Bob said to me when he got to the team was, I've heard you've got potential. We're going to find out. I'm going to play you 30 minutes a night, and we're going to find out if you can play in this league or not. So Bob Hartley was a huge reason why I think I was able to sort of, you know, go past that point and secure myself as a top four defenseman in the NHL for a number of years. So, you know, and then I had years, you know, in different times where I wasn't in that top four role. Like when I first got to New York with the Islanders, I had a few injuries, and it was always hard to come back from these things. Like people would think it was so easy, right? And it's just, I had so many like catastrophic injuries and surgeries. I had 14 surgeries over a 16-year span, and coming back from these things, restoring to normalcy was such a challenge. And you know, getting in there, I think I was in the six, seven position for a bit, and Scott Gordon was the coach, and I can remember he called me in for a meeting, and I was in there with Jack Hillen and I think Freddie Meyer. And he said, just so you guys know, you guys are all fighting for the number six spot. And that was like another one of these light bulb moments where I was like, hell no, I'm not doing this. I ended up playing well, taking advantage of opportunities. I ended up, you know, getting in the top pair there with Mark Streit within a short period of time. And I think he did it to light a fire under my ass. And it did. And it's just all these little things, these little moments that happen in, you know, over the course of a long career that are the difference between, you know, sticking around and shutting it down.
Andy Sutton joins us in story time. You know, and I love the, you know, kind of the behind the scenes stuff. You know, Jacques Lemaire, you know, wanted to turn you back into, what was his reasoning why he felt like you could help as a forward?
Well, he was, you know, and it was a great opportunity for me. You know, I think I always had, you know, pretty good mobility for a big guy, and I had good hands. You know, I grew up playing forward, and I always, you know, liked that feeling. I loved being the offensive side of things, and I always practiced it because it was fun for me, and it's exciting to try to score. So even like, though I ended up mostly being known for, you know, the hard-nosed defensive style, that was really bred out of necessity to stick around, you know, and I think Jacques saw that. He's like, wow, this guy can really skate, you know, for his size. He's got good hands. So he started putting me in front of the net on the power play. I had a couple multi-goal games. Like, I had some really great games. And I think he's like, you know, we can do this. And then we were deep on defense. I mean, we had like Curtis Lecision, and we had Sean O'Donnell, and we had, you know, young Willie Mitchell. And we had some really good players. Brad Bombardier was there. I mean, we had some really good players, a couple European guys that were exceptional players. And I think he just thought, maybe this is a better place for me to slot him in. I can, you know, put him on the third line. He can crank some guys, and we can put him out for power play when it makes sense. And, you know, but I would have always been behind, you know, Marian Gaborik and all these guys. I was never going to be the guy that played on the one or, you know, first or second line as a forward. So I just had a gut feeling that this wasn't going to be, you know, right for me for longevity. And then, you know, another fueling component of it. And since we're doing story time, I might as well go all the way in with it. I went to Mike Ramsey, and I said, Mike, I just feel like, you know, and this is the defense coach, right? He's a legend, right? And I'm like, Mike, yeah. I just think to stick around this game, I'm like, I think I need to be a defenseman. He looked me square in the face, and he goes, Sutsy, you'll never be a defenseman in this league. And that was it for me. Like, it hit a chord in me, And I was just like, I'm going to show you and everybody else that I can be not only a defenseman in this league, but I can be a top four defenseman and I can stick around a long time. And that always fueled me. I always heard those words. And, you know, I think in general athletes, most athletes, especially guys, you know, probably more in my position that have to scrap and, you know, and fight to stick around, you never really feel that settled. You know, I always felt like I was, you know, one game away from being out of the lineup or getting traded or something like that. So you live kind of on pins and needles for the course of your career, and you're always like in that fight or flight mode. So I think that was just all part and parcel.
Andy Sutton joins us. You know, Andy, I love it. Strutty, who's not here right now, but he talked about, you know, he was a young guy when he got traded to Van. He went to his first camp, and Mike Milbury, his first camp, sent him to the minors and said, "You'll never play in the NHL."
So yeah, he was
pretty annoyed. Yeah. Like, it's kind of amazing that, you know, somebody would say that. Did you ever talk to Ramsey about it later?
You know what? I never bumped into him again after that, you know, and I don't know if he's ever heard the story, but, like, I don't know why anyone would ever say that. You know, maybe he was just trying to be honest. I'm sure maybe he felt it. I just, you know, and maybe the honesty is the most important thing. You know, maybe that's a coach's responsibility to say, look, you don't fit here. You know, like that doesn't work here. But for him to say, like, you know, in general, like, you're never going to be a defenseman in this league, I mean, that's a pretty strong statement. And, you know, I was destined to prove him wrong. And I think, you know, when you have a career like I had, and you know, you've got to kind of reinvent yourself like a hockey chameleon all the time, right? Like, you're just, you know, you've got to fight sometimes. You've got to take an offensive role sometimes. You've got to take this very, you know, team-oriented approach if you're like a 6'7" guy. And, you know, when I found myself in Edmonton at the end, it happened to me again. You know, I think I had a decent year for the age that I was at. I was much older than everybody else, and the team was so young, and I'd signed a one-year extension, and I go in at the end of the year, and this was after all the suspensions and all the crap that I dealt with that year, and Tom Rennie says to me, says, "Sutsy, I just want you to know you're probably going to play 40 games or less next year." And I looked at him and I said, "Tom, you know me better than that. You know I'm not going to accept that, right?" So I go into that summer and I'm training harder than I've ever trained before. And I always trained hard. And I end up, I'm doing these jump squats and I've got these bands attached to the barbell. And then you go right into these double leg bounds. And I didn't really feel anything. And then I'd go skate after. And I got halfway through the skate and I couldn't bend my leg anymore. So I take off my shin guards and go, and my knee is blown up like a soccer ball, right? So, and you're so hard-lined to want to, you know, rinse, repeat, right? Like, I'm going to be fine. I'll ice it. I'll do this, that. You don't assume it's, you know, catastrophe all the time, despite all the injuries I had. So I went through this routine for a couple weeks. I'd ice it all week. I'd skate on Monday morning, and by Monday afternoon, this thing's blown up. So I call my agent at the time, and I say, "Hey, look, I think I've hurt my knee." And he says, "Well, you got to get on the next plane to Edmonton," because I think he knew the lock. He had some inside scoop that the lockout was coming. So I get on a plane to Edmonton, and I get an MRI, and the team doc comes in, and he looks at me, and he literally says, "What the heck have you been doing?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You broke off a piece of the base of your femur in your knee joint. You literally snapped off a piece the size of your pinky finger, and it's floating around in your knee joint." He said, "What have you been doing?" So I told him. I had immediate surgery, right? And then they wanted to do a couple more advanced procedures to get me going. And just the timing in my life, you know, and I always assumed I was going to play into my 40s. I was still feeling good, and I was really into it, and I was enjoying the transitional role of supporting the young players. And I just at that time, I had some personal things going on, and I decided to shut it down. So the saddest story for me, like, after all my whole career, is the last game I played in Edmonton was in Vancouver. It was the last game of the year. We weren't going to make the playoffs, and they'd brought up all kinds of guys from the minors. So the boys are all, like, we're having a good time, right? Like, last month or whatever, and I know I'm not playing. Well, the second last game of the year, three guys go down with injury, and they call me in the morning at, like, 10 in the morning in Vancouver, and they say, "Sutsy, you got to play tonight." I was like, "Are you kidding me?" Like, I haven't played a game in over a month. And so I go out, and, you know, you go out and do your best, but just literally try not to get injured. I didn't want to take an injury in the summer, so... It was just kind of an interesting sort of, you know, collision of events that was my last NHL game. There was no swan song. There was no party. There was no thank you. There was no anything. It just literally ended up in the end ending for me because of the injury, the lockout, and then my desire to not go through, you know, some invasive surgery to try to go it again. So it's kind of it was kind of anticlimactic in the end.
Andy, I want to go back to, you mentioned with the Atlanta Thrashers, and you got there, and the coach says, "Hey, I want to see if you're good. I'm going to play you." And he did play a lot, and you know, you had your two best offensive seasons there with 8 goals and in both 04 and 06, kind of bookend between the lockout season. So in that lockout season, you played for two different Swiss teams. Tell me about how you got hooked up with the GCK Lions in the Swiss B League, and then I guess you got promoted to the A League, or did you play in the A1 first and then the B? How'd that work?
Well, I went with the intention of playing in the B League, really mostly just to have a good time, stay in shape. You know, it certainly wasn't for the money; it was more about the experience. But my good friend Randy Robitaille was over there. You know, top scorer for the head team in Zurich. Invited me over. I flew over to meet the team and see if it was going to be a good fit. And it looked like it was going to be a good time. And they had a really nice infrastructure set up. So I went over and they called me up for a few games. You know, really it was not the intention. I was very happy playing in the B League and just having a good time. So, but one of the great experiences of my career for sure. I relished that opportunity and got a chance to see that whole country and all the neighboring countries and really milk that experience to the fullest for sure.
Well, I would think as a Canadian, Andy, when you got over there, you probably were amazed, like, just how close everything was, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you want to travel across Canada, like, you know, it's taken days by car. You know, over there, you're in Zurich, you're getting to so many different countries by a short train trip.
Oh, for sure. You're so central. You've got so much opportunity. The mountains are there. It's such a tight knit community. And then, yeah, like you said, you're in the neighboring countries in a half a day and having just incredible experience. It was really, you know, because of all the playing and stuff like that, I never really got a chance to do that. I know a lot of people do that through college or maybe when they, you know, right when they stopped playing. I went right from business, you know, business of school to the business of life. And I never really got a chance to tour over there until that point in time. So it was a really an incredible experience for me.
Then you come back to the NHL, Andy, and the game, the rules changed. As a big defenseman, and you're pretty mobile though, was the rule change good for you? Or did it take some time to adjust all the obstruction?
The obstruction took everybody a minute, I think, you know, and for a while there, you know, the Mike Rathje, Darian Hatcher, era of player was really when I came into the game, right? So it probably hindered me from a standpoint of just really being, a more highly coveted asset because the big defensemen that were strong, that were allowed to clutch and grab were such a commodity. And then when that changed, the only reason I think I was able to stick around was because I was a decent skater. And I was able to evolve that portion of the game. And I think that change was easy. The changes that came, you know, near the end of my career with all the headshot stuff and some of those things was a more difficult change for me. And I think really what happened in the end was kind of like the death of the dinosaur. You know, you watch all the players like me go away and when I watch the games now, I see so much swinging and players keeping speed, and the type of play has definitely changed. I mean, the tendency to keep your speed up and not waste energy to rub somebody out is definitely there. But in the end, and you saw this last year, especially with St. Louis, that brand of hockey seems to always be there in the end, and those seem to be the teams that figure out how to hoist the cup when it's all said and done. So I'm hopeful that there's, you know, some resurgence of a hybrid, you know, hybrid model, because I think part of what people love about our game is the fight, you know, is the grit, you know, the tenacity of the players. And I don't like when I see guys just swing by guys, especially in the playoffs. I have a tough time watching it.
Andy Sutton joins us on Edmonton Sports Leader TSN 1260. And Andy, when you look back and you talk about all those suspensions, was there one that frustrated you the most?
Well, I think, yeah, they all frustrated me because, you know, you don't want to give that money away. But at the same point in time, you know, and coming up, my first team getting to watch Brian Marchment play, right, and just see – the fear that he imparted onto the, you know, players that he played against. And he took the suspensions, and I always put it in the marketing column in my mind. I was like, okay, like, at least people know I'm here to play for keeps, right? But that year in Edmonton, and I step up in the middle to hit Gabriel Landeskog, right, who's super strong, obviously incredible skater. And I think what happened when he, you know, Shane, my good buddy Shane O'Brien, throws him a suicide pass, you know, everybody on the bench and in the building screams at the same time. And he swerved out of the way to get off the trucks. I mean, I didn't move. I didn't reach with anything. And I clip him. I break his nose. You know, he's hurt, right? Shane comes and I got to fight my good buddy because of it. It's like when I started seeing stuff like that, and then, you know, all this principal point of contact stuff, and with Shanahan coming in, and I was definitely made a poster boy for change. And, you know, in retrospect, you know, and even, you know, probably the hit I'm known most for, the one on Leopold in the playoffs with Ottawa, when I look at that now, I think, my goodness, like that man has a family. You know, he's got kids and a whole life left to live. And I actually regret that now in retrospect, that I played that way. But at the same point in time, that's the way the game was then, and we didn't know any different. It was kill or be killed type of mentality in a lot of ways. And then the brand of play that I embodied was kind of surrounded by that, you know, blocking shots, hitting hard, you know, making players, you know, accountable for trying to play a certain way, and definitely trying to protect that blue line and the goal crease in a very, you know, violent way, quite honestly. So, as you know, I think the game's in a better place from the standpoint of protecting the players. I think I'm hopeful that we can get a little bit of a hybrid model in there that's a little bit, you know, more connected to the past, because as I said, I think it's important that grit stays in our game.
Andy Sutton joins us on Edmonton Sports Leader, TSN 1260. And Andy, when you retired, lots of guys struggle with post-life after the NHL. You didn't. You got right into business. But that was something, because didn't you take, like, business when you were at Michigan Tech? And weren't you kind of doing some, you know, business stuff while you played?
Well, I studied engineering at school, and okay. I always had a really inquisitive mind, still do. And I, you know, and at the time I was like, okay, I've got this scholarship. I don't know if I'll play hockey after this. You know, I turned down an internship with the U.S. Navy the summer before my senior year, and I seriously contemplated going. I decided to give hockey one more kick at the can. So I stayed at school. It was the only summer I stayed there. I trained my ass off and got in great shape. And then, you know, lo and behold, it seemed like everything was sort of, you know, manifest destiny that year. And it really changed the course of my life. So I don't know. I mean, it was an interesting journey for sure. And then, you know, playing hockey in the NHL as long as I did, I started really paying attention to the equipment because of all the injuries, right? So I was constantly adding a pad, removing a pad, you know, altering the stuff that, you know, in a lot of instances, you know, shin guards in particular, and they haven't changed in 50 years. And quite honestly, you know, with guys shooting at it, you know, every guy starting to shoot it harder and harder with the introduction of the new sticks, we were getting lit up back there. So I was the first guy to put skate guards on. You know, Joe Gilmay was the assistant equipment manager in Atlanta when I was there, and he made a carbon fiber mold of the top of my skate and sides of my skate. And then he drilled in holes on the top of the foot and put dummy laces in, so it looked like it was part of the skate. I was the first guy to do that. You know, and I started looking at patenting and developing intellectual property in the protective space. So I actually started doing that about 4 years before I retired. And then coming right out of retirement, and even during, I went right into trying to license those technologies to brands like Easton and Bauer and CCM, and started to really hone my business acumen while I was still playing. So I was straddling a line a little bit, which I'm so thankful for now. And then, you know, not to say that it was easy, because I can tell you what, like even being able to, you know, have made some good money and have something to latch onto, the transition is really hard. It's really challenging for every athlete, because it's a different world out here. The business world and life outside of it is just outside of the game, and especially game at the highest level when you play for a long time, it's completely different. Things go at a different pace. It's not all about, like, what can you do this shift, or, you know, how did you do today in this game? It's more of a long play. You've got to make You've got to make quality decisions that allow you to put, you know, one foot in front of the other that lead to the promised land over time. It's not about these sort of like, you know, this immediacy that you're so used to living in, right? You're so hyper-focused on this next shift or this next period or this next game or this next chunk of games or whatever it is, and you have such a microscopic viewpoint of life and probably, quite frankly, the world. And then when you try to take that into real life, it just doesn't apply. It doesn't work. So that's the thing I think that's the hardest. And then I think a lot of guys, myself included, even in a way, sometimes like you kind of start to self-medicate, right? You might start drinking more. You don't understand. You're flipped upside down, and you've really got to understand what's going on here. And then you have to get lucky too to find something that motivates you, because that's the other thing. It's inherent in you, because from the time you're little, you get this stick stuck in your hand. It's the be all and end all. And then lo and behold, you become good at it, right? So now it's all fueled inside the ego. Hey, you're good at it. You're good at it. And then they start paying you all kinds of money to play this thing. So it's all about hockey. And then poof, just like that, it's done. Right. And now you've got to redefine the variables that uphold your self-worth. Right. So you've got to start from scratch. You have to have the thing that gets you up in the morning where you can put the intensity that you certainly have in your life into. It's got to be fueled by passion or it's never going to work. And then you have to be able to have sort of a longer term approach to it. You can't divide it by this sort of microscopic outlook. So that's the what I would say is sort of the thing that I would offer and lend to it coming out the backside, just based on my own personal experience.
And Andy, before we let you go, of course, you've taken your engineering, you're an entrepreneur, you're the president of Wholesale Sports Incorporated. You got the inline hockey brand, Elkilly, you know, and some apparel stuff. And you also have the rebranding, Verbero. How's that gone? The Mercury V35 stick, for anybody who doesn't remember the old Mercuries, love that stick.
Yeah, so the story's changed a little bit. I left Wholesale Sports. Okay. I was over there, and I was a partner in the First Star brand, which is the former Canadian apparel brand. I was the acting president there for about 4.5 years. I took Verbero outside of Wholesale Sports. I'm the new owner of Verbero. Verbero's my full-time job. I work on it every single day, all day long. I've got an amazing team I've built behind me. We put an incredible program together, all, you know, backed by the innovative product that the brand has. We brought the, as you said, the Mercury V350 stick, and 350 is for, it's 350 grams. It's the lightest stick ever brought to market. We have the only full carbon fiber skate, all Japanese grade carbon fiber. We're a team direct brand. We supported everything with a robust apparel program. We have a private label partner and several manufacturing partners that we use for both game wear, on ice, off ice apparel. We make all our own bags, basically every accessory you could ever imagine. And then the next thing that we add in, which is really the backbone of our infrastructure, is we created a proprietary software system whereby we create e-commerce extensions of Verbero.com for our brand partners. So team, effectively online team stores. So all of the catalog products that we have available, we turn into an e-commerce team store for our approved partners. And we host those on Verbero.com/team/team name. Those products are available 24/7, 365. All of the apparel in the team's colorways, their team logos, all of our pants are set up in such a way that they can be decorated on demand with a team logo. We brought in team color sticks. So we're really the team brand, 100% the team brand. We want to be known as a team brand. We want to be known for this e-commerce extension and our ability to support teams with this type of thing. And then we sell team direct pricing to everybody. So our stick, despite the fact that it's as top tier a stick as any stick I've ever used, we sell it at under $200. Our skate is comparable to the high-end skates. So you're looking at $1,200 skates. We're at $295 retail. So we put innovation, performance, value, and accessibility in the same sentence. And that's really what Verbero is all about.
That's awesome, Andy. I love it. You found another passion in life, which is great. It's always good to catch up with you. Thanks so much for your candor. As always, we appreciate it, and the continued success in business.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Be well, and we'll do this again sometime, I hope.